thought I knew you as well as I know this house.
Hello, and welcome to the third podcast in a series of specially commissioned recordings brought to you by Thresholds, the online international short story forum hosted by the University of Chichester, who have joined forces this year with Small Wonder, the short story festival, to record four special discussions that we're calling Short Story Masterclass. My name's Steve Wasserman, and in this podcast you're about to hear, I'll be talking to the wonderfully expansive, soulful, and psychologically acute writer Michelle Roberts. We start off with Michelle reading from a story that's become a bit of a classic, really, Your Shoes, and I ask her how she felt about having a story that's, well, joined the canon and anthologized, studied by schoolchildren.
I thought I knew you as well as I know this house. No secret places, no hidey holes. Nothing in you I couldn't see. Now I realise how you kept yourself from me, how I didn't really know you at all. You're not here any longer, so how can I speak to you? You can't speak to someone who isn't there. Only mad people talk to an empty chest of drawers, a bed that hasn't been slept in for weeks. Someone half mad, with grief that is, might pick up a shoe from the rug and hold it like a baby. Someone like me might do that. As if the shoe might still be warm or give a clue to where you've gone. One shoe pointed, in fact, towards the bedroom window, the view of the front garden, and the other pointed towards the door. They wanted to get out, to get away, just like you did. I made them neat again. I stowed them in the wardrobe, just in case. I locked the wardrobe door on those rebellious shoes. They could be like me and grieve in the darkness. For a bit. Then I let them out. I'm not cruel, but they've got to learn, haven't they? Kids these days. Well.
That's fantastic reading, thank you.
Even though all my life I've been very interested in the subject of mother-daughter relationships, it hasn't been something that's been valued, I think, within the culture as a whole, or explored much, apart from, in terms of the arts, by women who are in a sense explicitly feminist in some way, and therefore know that relationships between women are really important and really matter a great deal, but haven't always received a great deal of attention. So I was thrilled that a subject I thought had been to some extent ignored, perhaps by male writers or a certain kind of female writer, would actually be offered to schoolchildren to think about. And what I find interesting about the mother-daughter relationship is there's this taboo quality to it. It's not important. But I think that the tabooness comes from the fact that the mother-daughter relationship contains such violence, such passionate adoration, such passionate devotion, but also such accusations of coldness, of hatred, of villainy. And I suppose the story, Your Shoes, is a story that's trying to explore how does a mother let go of her daughter? And how does a daughter leave her mother? Because in the great exemplar of our culture, which is the male-female relationship, you know, there are physical signs of difference between the sexes. Usually just the male sign is held up as this is what makes men different from women. They've got something that women haven't got. Nonetheless, there's a division, there's a separation. Men and women can talk to each other across that and try and find out who they are as people. With two women, you haven't got an obvious sign of difference. You could feel that you're identical. So how do you both become full human beings if you can't use that easy sign of physical difference? And I think, as a result, the mother-daughter relationship can be very fraught. There's that simple thing of how the two women distinguish themselves from each other. Sometimes the daughter so loves and adores her mother, she's got to fight her way out of what could feel like a suffocating embrace. Sometimes the mother is conscious or not quite conscious enough of something that might have been lacking in her life, and she wants the daughter to act it out for her. So in a sense, she might want to try and control her daughter and push her in a certain direction, and the daughter will have to fight back. And sometimes they just love each other so much that they want to hang on forever and not let go. It's a very, very rich area, I think. So I was thrilled to bits that school children were going to have to think about it. Because they're all going through it, that's the thing. Even boys, I mean, they're not even supposed to have feelings for their mothers after a certain age. But I thought, well, they might like to read this story and realise that mothers are people who evoke very strong feelings. And boys are traditionally supposed to run away from their mothers. So what happens if they want to hang on and cling? They're called Nancy boys, poofters, gay. They're, you know, awful insults.
Mm. So, with, I mean, as you say, you wrote it a number of years ago. How much of what you've just spoken about was conscious to some extent when you were writing it? I mean, there is a moment in the story, isn't there, where as a reader you are sort of floored, and I think that's where it really sort of kicks in, when some of that aggression that the mother has towards her daughter suddenly starts coming out. You know, sort of, how are you making your money? Have you turned to prostitution? Like, whoa, hang on. Where did that come from? How does that work when you're writing? I mean, those sort of moments when suddenly the story turns, is that something you do quite intuitively, or is that something that you actually sort of plot out in a way?
As far as I can remember writing that story, and it was a while ago, I had a very strong sense of the mother to begin with, just as somebody who was feeling something very strongly, which was seeing this physical item, a pair of white trainers. And all the story, of course, comes out of that. So the story is about loss and absence, and the shoes stand for the absent daughter. So it was only through writing it that I began to understand who the mother might be and how she might feel about her daughter. And that's how writing works, I think. I honestly do think it's better to write the way I do, which is you don't have a big plan before you start. You find things out through writing, because the act of writing is very mysterious and wonderful. It invokes the unconscious. The unconscious is your deep creative self, and it brings up, as you're writing, all kinds of helpful stuff. It deepens and enriches the story. And at the same time, because I have thought about the mother-daughter relationship all my writing life, I think I had lots of possible kinds of mothers in my mind, and one of them stepped centre stage. And I really did want to write about a woman who might envy her daughter, even hate her sometimes, be so angry with her, because I think the feeling of loss is very linked to the feeling of anger. The feeling of anger can be very linked to the feeling of envy. It all felt quite truthful for the kind of woman that particular woman was. It's not a universal story. It's not all mothers hate their daughters or compete with them or envy them. Not at all. It's a very particular woman who's suffered a great deal in her own life. But in a way, she's taking that out on her daughter, I think.
I mean, in some ways, I think, a great story is always sort of about something else than what its presiding theme or plot is about. I mean, for you, what is this story about? What is it about for you? I mean, you've in some sense, you've already said, but what is the unspoken plot of this story, or the unspoken theme here?
Well, since I quite often believe in the death of the author and the power of the reader to make up the sense or meaning of a story, I could just be rather rude to you and say, well, it's not for me to say, and it's absolutely up to you, because you're the powerful one, you're the reader. But I had a sense when writing the story that I was writing about something which felt extremely sad to me, which is that so many women feel unnurtured in the culture we live in, which is still a culture that, although men suffer greatly in it from macho expectations they can't live up to, privileges men if they want to make use of those privileges, and I think damages women a great deal by telling women we've got to be thin, beautiful, sexy, perfect, brilliant mothers, blah 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 blah. That's not a nurturing culture, and it has a terrible effect on women. And some women recognise that and try and do something with that knowledge and that hurt. And other women are so trapped in it, they can't do a lot. So I'm often very angry about the condition of women in our culture, which appears to give women, you know, if they're middle class and white, privileges, but actually is telling them all the time their bodies are awful. So I think the story's about my anger and sorrow about a culture that can't value and cherish women. But if the reader doesn't feel that, then that reader needs to say what he thinks the story's about, because that's just as interesting or more interesting than what I think it's about. Every morning I walked into work at the university from a nearby village where I rented a room from a sad widow. I was a widow myself, in a manner of speaking. I'd run off and left my husband. But you wouldn't have known it to look at me, unless you thought all women of 35 were in mourning. Black clothes were fashionable at that time. We all wore them. I strode in my long black mackintosh along the muddy roads edged by fields into the great park, and thence, following a footpath, to my place of work. Every morning I laced up my shoes, flat black suede brogues, with a thick dimpled rubber sole, a pointed triangular toe, just two eyelets, and a black lace, thin as a string of licorice, that I tied into a sharp bow. My mother frequently scolded me for my childishness. You see everything in terms of food and eating. Those black suede shoes, when I'd spotted them, furry and glistening in the shop, had indeed seemed good enough to eat. At night, when I walked back to my lodgings, to my small front bedroom in my landlady's cramped modern house, my shoes sat by the side of my single bed while I ate my bowl of spaghetti and drank my wine. And then I'd lift the shoes up, one after the other, wipe and brush them tenderly, scrape and fiddle off with the tip of a knife the caked mud that clotted them.
Maybe turning now to a story that's in your most recent collection, Mud, the title story, which also has shoes in it, and laces like licorice. Is that metaphor that you've used something very conscious of you returning and sort of re-mining or mining again a metaphor?
Yeah, I think in a writer's imagination, which is your own little personal collection of bits and pieces and stuff, to you they may be treasures, to other people they may be rubbish, but actually I love rubbish and I think you can turn it into treasures. You may have some dominant images that you return to over and over and again because you can make them work differently. So a pair of shoes doesn't mean much. If you translate it, it's a pair of white trainers left behind. You can start to talk about a teenage girl. If it's a pair of black suede brothel creepers that someone's using because she needs flat shoes for walking along a country road, but she's still very conscious of appearance, you've got a different kind of character. There's another story in one of my books about a girl who feels she has very large feet, and the story is just about all the different shoes she's worn through her life. So I suppose I love metaphor, and I love the kind of metaphor where a little thing stands for an awful lot. And for me, shoes can stand for cultural ideas around femininity, which are to do with high heels and, if you like, even themes of castration. And shoes can also stand for adventure, because if they're flat-soled, you can run in them. You can get away. They seem to me a brilliant, very compressed way of evoking a human life. Mm. You know how shoes after death hold the shape of the dead person's foot? So a memory of a dead person can reside in their shoe because of its shape. And that's why so many people get very, very upset clearing out after someone's died, because it's the shoes that hold the person's body in a very particular way.
Which, of course, is what happens to the mother in your shoes, doesn't she? She's clearing out her mother's shoes and then gets upset, and it's that compels her then to go and buy the shoes for her daughter, doesn't it? Which is an interesting sort of working out of something going on there.
I've got key images that I come back to and back to, and some reviewers get very angry with me because they think it's laziness or not noticing, but it isn't, it's deliberate. I'm just saying, here it is again, I want to work with it again. See what I can do with it this time.
I mean, there's a lovely line about metaphor in the story,
where you say, children want to eat the world, it's a way of knowing, touch the world, stroke it, grasp it, pick it up, cram it into your mouth. Children who can't yet talk don't understand metaphor. They want mud, the real thing. And that line really struck me. I suppose it struck me because I have been reading in tandem mud with Paper Houses. And in Paper Houses, you have a chapter in which you, Michelle Roberts, go and live with a widow in Wivenhoe. And of course, mud is about a character going and living with a widow in Wivenhoe. And in a way, I suppose, I don't know, I mean, there's so many sort of, so many ways we could kind of go with this. I suppose the first thing is, well, is there a difference? Where does the fiction and the non-fiction for you kind of start and finish? Why is the one a short story and the other is a memoir?
All my life I've been thinking about the relationship of something called experience to art, and therefore of autobiography to fiction. And I've changed my mind as I've gone on and I've experimented and written a great deal. I think I like to experiment with taking images that have existed in my life, like a pair of shoes, crust of mud, a widow living in Wivenhoe, and see what I can do with them. So it was nice to record in the memoir that I really had been writer in residence at Essex University and I really had lived in Wivenhoe, and I was able to write a quite rapturous account of the walk from Wivenhoe to the university. I think the light and shade were different in the memoir. What was central in the memoir wasn't the same as what was central in the story. So it's simply a sort of method of assemblage, if you like, or collage, that you collect up images, visual very often for me, but they could be oral or taste or smell, and you play with them and you make different things with them. And sometimes the repertoire feels huge and sometimes I return to a few favourite images, but I think I'm doing something different with them. That's it, really. It's a form of playing.
Mm.
Because memoir, we know, I think, because of neuroscience and everything, that imagination and memory are very deeply linked. I mean, the older I get, the more I know that. So that I know when you write a memoir, you're making it up, you're composing it. That's the point. And I know that when you write fiction, you may be drawing upon things that have happened to someone called I. Mm. So the overlap is tremendously interesting. It shifts about all the time. And that's why you write another book. You know, you think, oh, that's it. It's changed, it's different.
Mm. I mean, one thought I had, you know, in response to the children who can't yet talk, don't understand metaphor, they want mud, the real thing, was that as adults, perhaps adults who can talk and can understand metaphor, we also want mud. We still want mud. And I'm not sure exactly what that means in terms of us wanting mud. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I would be fascinated to know what you think, because that's really important. It's a conversation. I think for me it means I've retained a very childish way of experiencing the world, which is very sensual. And it's something I trust because it's so direct and close. I can think about literature and I write about it, I've written criticism, I've written essays, I've written lectures and given them at universities. I'm much more comfortable with making art that tells me what mud tastes like than with giving a lecture on mud as a metaphor in Michelle Roberts or D.H. Lawrence or whoever it is, because that's the kind of person I am. That isn't much of an answer, but it also comes from being a Catholic. Catholics are taught a central miracle, which I write about in my memoir. I take a whole chapter trying to explain quite how damaging it can be to be Catholic, in that in the sense of you're told that something that looks like bread and wine is the body and blood of Christ. It really, really is. It's not a metaphor, it is. So it means that anything you say, this is that, is true. So that can get you into all kinds of trouble. I mean, for me, it got me into trouble because I thought by saying my father is my lover as a little girl in love with my daddy, that it was true. It therefore meant we'd had incestuous relations. It therefore meant I was wicked beyond belief and he was. And we would be cast out forever. And it wasn't until, you know, really into my 30s that I understood it was a metaphor. Me saying, I wish daddy could be my lover. I love him as much as though he were my lover. And of course, I'd been writing poetry using metaphor all that time, but not really knowing what metaphor was. For me, it was always the truth. If I said, God is the grass, God was the grass, you know. If I said, I am a lion, I am a lion. And in a way, that's a very religious sense of the world. So saying, I want mud, I want the real thing. Mm. It is quite a religious statement for someone who's been brought up to know that the body and blood is the bread and wine. I can't really explain it because these truths of Catholicism are beyond language. That's the point. They're mysteries. And there comes a point where you just think, no, I can't possibly do this anymore. It's impossible. Mm. And you start to see the bread and wine as metaphors for the body and blood of Christ. And there had I been, you know, reading John Donne, reading all the 17th century religious poets who as Protestants explore all this stuff. I don't think I could understand it intellectually. I just lapped it up and adored it. Mm. I'm not able to answer your question
properly. No, I mean, I suppose, I mean, for me, the mud, I mean, of course, there's always this ongoing and perennial debate, isn't there, about how much of a writer's life, how much of sort of the facts, as good old Philip Roth called his memoir, a writer does put into their fiction, and there's always a sense of maybe writers sort of covering up the traces a little bit. And I think, in a way, that as readers, we enjoy, maybe it's just a fantasy, we enjoy the fantasy that this is actually, there is something really real and something, there's some real mud here from the writer. It's not all kind of just invented. It's not just pure invention. Mm. I mean, I was doing an interview with Joseph O'Connor yesterday, and he said, I have no interest in myself. Mm. I have no interest in myself. I'm not one of those solipsistic, navel-gazing writers who, you know, transmute my experience into my stories. And I was sort of slightly disappointed to hear that. Mm. I saw my response, which I didn't say to him, but my response was almost, well, why am I reading you if you have no interest in yourself?
Mm. Well, that's very male, you see. That's all about, it's self-indulgent. And it means an internal world, but that's what women have. It's wombs and things. Right. And men have to be these arrows shooting off into the universe. I just think he's being a fantastically conventional man saying that. But I'd take up something you said, which is, you see, mud is just a word. I mean, that's the point. So I could talk to you endlessly about my experiences in Wivenhoe and whether they come into the memoir or whether they come into a short story. But what actually matters is in the memoir and or in the short story is how the image, the word, is functioning, is being used. That's what matters, is language. And language is not experience, it's something completely different. Yeah, yeah. It's the material. So I love what you said about wanting mud. For me it means I love the visceral, I love the physical, I love the sensual, I love what's called dirty, I love what is called playing with mess in the gutter, because that's all about sort of breaking the rules of the culture about being clean and tidy and a good girl. And mud therefore means sexuality, perhaps sexuality of the wrong kind, for the Pope anyway. So mud is still working as a metaphor.
When you sit down to write a story, are you aware, is there something within you, that a little chime, a little siren or something that goes off where you kind of think, oh, I'm taking a risk here, and that kind of makes it exciting and makes it worthwhile writing the story?
It's not that so much, although that's a rather beautiful and lovely way of... I'll think about that. It's more that I think when I start to write anything, all kinds of revolting wishes to self-censor or not tackle taboos can flood in, I'm sure from my Catholic past, and I've got to get through them, got to fight my way through them. So taking a risk actually is about some kind of emotional truthfulness for me, that you push through something that you know is quite conventional and possibly quite cliched, or you've done it before too often, or you don't really believe it but it might sound quite nice in a story. You try and get to a point where this is the truth of that character. So I wrote a story about a woman who stalks a celebrity chef, and I really felt I could imagine what it was like to be a stalker, a female stalker, who's driven by her hunger for love to the extent that she will commit a terrible crime at the end of the story. And of course it was frightening to write about that, because it's about someone who's prepared to be that aggressive, that violent, that needy, that mad. And I could discover all those things in myself. In order to write that character, I could feel all her stuff in me. So that's the risk, I think, is that you're somehow exploring your own unconscious and your own shadow as much as making this piece of art. That's what I feel. I'm using my own shadow for the risk taking.
And what does the pushing through entail when you're actually sitting there in front of the screen or with the pen in your hand? I mean, what is the process for you of, first of all, recognizing that there is a need for the push, and then the actual pushing?
Well, it's because I can tell when I write badly. So the first draft or two may be quite conventional, it may be quite social realistic, it may be too close to my own life, like reportage of some kind. And it's just dull and lifeless and it's a bit dead. And it may be very competently written, but I'm not happy with it. So I've got to scrap it, I've got to cross it out, or I've got to edit it heavily. And it's a process of rewriting and rewriting and rewriting and re-editing until it might feel like going down, or it might feel like going out and forwards. It depends.
And how do you know when the writing then suddenly starts to move, to sort of pulse with its own life?
It's a very physical feeling, I think. Uh-huh. You know how Marina Tsvetaeva said that when she read a good poem, she got a tingling all up and down her spine? Well, it's like the French philosophers talk about the joy of reading. They invoke this term, la jouissance. So it's joy, but it also means coming. It's a very particular, precise term. I think you get that when you're writing really honestly, not in terms of relating your own experience at all, but to the truth of the situation, of the character, of the narrator. You get a feeling of jouissance that you trust. I think Nietzsche said somewhere, the body is a great wisdom. And I don't always agree with Nietzsche, but I think I might on that one. That you trust your deep writing self, which is simultaneously something quite physical. And it's kind of shuddering and giving you pleasure. You're getting a lot of pleasure. Well, oh, God, that all sounds so pompous. Let's end on
that. No, it doesn't
pleasure.
It doesn't sound pompous at all. I think that's actually the perfect note on which to end, on that excitement and that jouissance. And thank you so much for communicating some of that to us today, and it's been just lovely talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Your questions have really got me going, so thank you.
Right.